Stripped naked, Abberley waded out from the far shore until the water reached his chin and struck out in a dog paddle that made no splash and left only a silent, oily wake behind his head. When he reached the far shore, he lay in the shallows until he was certain the beach was clear. Then he crawled swiftly across the open sand and huddled against the bole of the first tree. One or two campfires were burning in the grove, and from around them he heard the sound of men's voices and an occasional snatch of song or a shout of laughter. The flames gave him enough light to discern the hut where the slaves were imprisoned. Near the front of it, he picked out the glow of a burning match on the lock of a musket, and from this he placed the single sentry, who sat with his back to a tree covering the door of the hut. "They are careless," he thought. "Only one guard, and he seems to be asleep." He crept forward on hands and knees, but before he reached the back wall of the hut, he heard footsteps and moved quickly to the shelter of another tree trunk and crouched there. Two of the buzzard sailors came sauntering through the grove towards him. They were arguing loudly. "I'll no sail with a little weasel," one declared. "He would cut a throat for the fun of it." "So would you, Willie MacGregor." "Aye, but I'd no be using a pizen blade like Sam Bowles would." "Ye'll save with whoever the buzzard says you will, and that's an end to your carping," his mate announced, and paused beside the tree where Abberley crouched. He lifted his petticoats and urinated noisily against the trunk. "By the devil's nuggets, even with Sam Bowles as captain, I'll be happy enough to get away from this place. I left bonnie Scotland to escape the coal pit, and here I am digging holes again." He shook the droplets vigorously from himself, and the two walked on. Abberley waited until they were well clear, and then crawled to the rear wall of the hut. He found that it was plastered with unburnt clay, but the chunks of this were falling from the framework of woven branches beneath. He crawled slowly along the wall, gently probing each crack with a stalk of grass, until he found a chink that went right through. He placed his lips to the opening and whispered softly, "Jiri!" He heard a startled movement on the far side of the wall, and a moment later a fearful whisper came back. "Is that the voice of Abberley, or is it a ghost?" "I am alive. Here, feel the warmth of my finger. 'Tis not the hand of a dead man." They whispered to each other for almost an hour before Abberley left the hut and crawled back down the beach. He slipped into the waters of the lagoon like an otter. The dawn was painting the eastern sky the colours of lemons and ripe apricots when Abberley climbed the hill again to where he had left Hal. Hal was not in the cave, but when Abberley gave a soft warbling bird call, he stepped out from behind the hanging vines that screened the entrance, his cutlass in his hand. "I have news," said Abberley. "For once the gods have been kind."
"Tell me,"
Hal commanded eagerly as he sheathed the blade. They sat side by side in the entrance to the cave, from where they could keep the full sweep of the lagoon under their eyes, while Abberley related in detail everything that Jiri had been able to tell him. Hal exclaimed when Abberley described the massacre of the captain and men of the Golden Bough, and the way in which Sam Bowles had drowned the wounded like unwanted kittens in the shallows of the lagoon. "Even for the buzzard that is a deed that reeks of hell itself."
"Not all were killed," Abberley told him. "Jiri says that a large number of the survivors are locked up in the main hold of the Golden Bough."
Hal nodded thoughtfully.
"He says, too, that the buzzard has given the command of the Golden Bough to Sam Bowles."
"By heaven, that rogue has come up in the world," Hal exclaimed. "But all this could work to our advantage. The Golden Bough has become a pirate ship, and is now fair game for us. However, it will be a dangerous enterprise to hunt the buzzard in his own nest."
He lapsed into a long silence, and Abberley did not disturb him. At last, Hal looked up, and it was clear he had reached some decision. "I swore an oath to my father never to reveal that which I am now to show you. But circumstances have changed. He would forgive me, I know. Come with me, Abberley."
Hal led him down the back slope of the hill, and then turned towards the gorge of the river. They found a trail made by the baboons, and scrambled down the steep side to the bottom. There, Hal turned upstream,
and the cliffs became higher and steeper as they went. At places they were forced to enter the water and wade alongside the cliff. Every few hundred yards, Hal paused to take his bearings, until at last he grunted with satisfaction as he marked the dead tree. He waded along the lip of the bank until he reached it, then scrambled ashore and began to climb.
"Where are you going, Gudwani?" Abeli called after him. "Follow me,"
Hal answered, and Abeli shrugged and began to climb after him. He chuckled when Hal suddenly reached down and gave him a hand onto the narrow ledge that he had not been able to see from below.
"Ho, ho, this has the smell of Captain Frankie's lair to it," he said. "The buzzard would have saved himself a lot of work by searching here instead of digging holes in the grove, am I right?"
"This way," Hal shuffled along the ledge with his back to the cliff, and the 100-foot drop that opened under his toes. When he reached the place where the ledge widened and the cleft split the face, he paused to examine the rocks that blocked the entrance.
"Oh, there'd be no visitors, not even the apes," he said with relief, and began to move the rocks out of the opening.
When there was space to pass, he crept through and groped in the darkness for the flint and steel box and the candle that his father had placed on the ledge above head level. The tinder flared at the third stroke of the steel on the flint, and he lit the candle stub and held it high. Abeli laughed in the yellow light as he looked upon the array of canvas sacks and chests.
"Hey, you are a rich man, Gundwani. But what use is all this gold and silver to you now? It will not buy you a mouthful of food or a ship to carry it all away."
Hal crossed to the nearest chest and opened the lid. The gold bars glinted in the candlelight. "My father died to leave me this legacy. I would rather have had him live and me a beggar." He slammed the lid and looked back at Abeli. "Despite what you may think, I did not come here for the gold," he said. "I came here for this." He kicked the powder keg beside him. "And those." He pointed to the piles of muskets and swords that were stacked against the far wall of the cave. "And these also." He crossed to where the sheaves and gantry were piled in a heap and picked up one of the coils of manila rope that he and his father had used. He tried the strength of the line by stretching a length of it over his back and straining to break it with his arms and shoulders. "It is still strong and has not rotted." He dropped the coil. "So we have all we need." Abeli came to sit on the chest beside him.
"So you have a plan. Then share it with me, Gundwani."
He listened quietly as Hal laid it out for him, and once or twice he nodded or made a suggestion. That same morning they set off for the base camp, and by travelling fast, trotting and running most of the way, they reached it shortly after noon. Sukina saw them climbing the hill and came running down to meet them. Hal seized her and swung her high in the air, then checked himself and set her down with great care, as though she were woven of gossamer and might easily tear.
"Forgive me, I treat you roughly." "I am yours to treat as you will, and I will be happier for it."
She clung to him and kissed him.
"Tell me what you have found. Is there a ship in the lagoon?"
"A ship. A fine ship, a beautiful ship, but not half as lovely as you." With Hal urging them, they broke the camp and moved out at once. He and Abeli scouted ahead to clear the path and to lead the band on towards the lagoon. When they reached the river and climbed down the gorge, Hal left Big Daniel there and all the other seamen but Ned Tyler. They were unaware that the treasure cave was only a cable's length upstream. "Wait for me here, Master Daniel. I must take the others to a safe place. Hide yourself well. I will return after dark." Abeli went with them, as Hal led the rest of his party up the far side of the gorge, then took them round the far side of the hills. They approached the sandbanks that separated the mainland from the island, on which they had built the fireships. By this time it was late afternoon, and Hal allowed them to rest there until nightfall. As soon as it was dark, they all waded across the shallows, Hal carrying Sukina on his back. As soon as they reached the island, they hurried deep into the thick bush, where they were safe from observation from the pirate encampment.
"No fires," Hal cautioned them. "Speak only in whispers. Swanchi, keep little Bobby from crying. No one to wander away. Keep close.
Ned is in command when I am not here. Obey him. Hal and Abberley went on across the island, through the bush to the beach facing the lagoon. In the area where they had built the fireships, the undergrowth had sprung up again thickly. They groped and searched beneath it until they located the two abandoned double-hulled vessels that had not been used on the attack on the Gull, and dragged them closer to the beach.
"Will they still float?" Abberley asked dubiously.
"Ned made a good job of them, and they seem sturdy enough," Hal told him. "If we unload the combustibles, then they will float higher in the water." They stripped the ships of their cargo of dry, tar-soaked wooden faggots. "Yes, that's better," Hal said with satisfaction. "They will be lighter and easier to handle now." They concealed them again, covering them with branches.
"There is still much to do before daylight."
Hal led Abberley back to where most of Althuda's party were already asleep.
"Do not wake Sukina," he warned her brother. "She is exhausted and must rest." "Where are you going?" Althuda asked. "There's no time to explain. We will return before dawn."
Hal and Abberley crossed the channel to the mainland and then hurried back through the forest in the darkness. But when they reached the line of hills, Hal stopped and said,
"There is something I have to find."
He turned back towards the flickering lights of the pirate camp, moving slowly and pausing often to get his bearings, until at last he stopped at the base of a tall tree.
"This is the one."
With the point of his cutlass, he probed the soft, loamy earth around the roots. He felt it strike metal and fell to his knees. He dug with his bare hands, then lifted the golden chain and held it to catch the starlight.
"It is your father's Nortonia seal,"
Abberley recognized it at once.
"The ring also,
and the locket with its portrait of my mother." Hal stood up and wiped the damp earth from the glass that had protected the miniature.
"With these in my hands, I feel a whole man again."
He dropped the treasures into his leather pouch.
"Let us go on before we are discovered."
It was after midnight when once again they scrambled down the side of the gorge, and Big Daniel challenged them softly as they reached the riverbank.
"'Tis me," Hal reassured him, and the others emerged from where they were hidden. "Stay here," Hal ordered. "Abberley and I will return shortly."
The two set off upstream. Hal led the climb to the ledge and groped his way into the blackness of the cave. Working in the candle's feeble light, they tied the cutlasses into bundles of 10, then stacked them at the entrance. Hal emptied one of the chests of its precious contents, piling the gold bars disdainfully in a corner of the cave, and packed 20 pistols into the empty chest. Then they rolled the kegs of gunpowder with the slow match out onto the narrow ledge and set up the gantry and sheave blocks with the rope rove through. Hal scrambled back down the cliff. When he reached the river bank, he whistled softly. Abberley lowered the bundles of weapons and the kegs down to him. It was heavy work, but Abberley's great muscles made light of it. When they had finished, Abberley climbed down to join Hal, and they began the wary porterage of the goods down to where Big Daniel and the other seamen waited.
"I recognize these," Big Daniel chuckled, as he ran his hands over a bundle of cutlasses, then examined them in the moonlight.
"Here is something else you will recognize," Hal told him, and gave him two of the heavy powder kegs to carry. All of them carrying as much as their backs would bear, they toiled up the side of the gorge, dumped their burdens, and then scrambled down again to bring up the next load. At last, fully laden, they struck out through the forest. Hal made only one detour to cache the two kegs of powder, a bundle of slow match, and 3 cutlasses in the cave of the rock paintings. Then they went on again. It was almost morning when at last they joined Althuda and his band on the island. They ate the cold smoked venison that Sukina and Swainchi had ready for them. Then, when the others rolled in their carosses, Hal took Sukina aside and showed her the great seal of the Nortonie and the locket.
"Where did you find these, Gundwani?"
"I hid them in the forest on the day we were captured."
"Who is the woman?"
She studied the portrait.
"Edwina Courtney, my mother."
"Oh, Hal, she is beautiful. You have her eyes."
"Give my son those same eyes."
"I will try. With all my heart,
I will try.
In the late afternoon, Hal roused the others and assigned their duties to them. Saba, take the pistols out of the chest and draw the loads. Reload them and then pack them back into the chest to keep them dry. The other man set to work at once. Big Daniel will help me load the boats. Ned, you take the women down to the beach and explain to them how to help you launch the second boat when the time comes. They must leave everything else behind. There will be neither space nor time to care for extra baggage.
Even my bags? Sukina asked.
Hal hesitated, then nodded firmly.
Even your bags, he said,
and she did not argue. Merely gave him a demure look from under her lashes before she and Swanchi, carrying Bobby strapped to her back, followed Ned away through the trees.
Come with me, Abelie.
Hal took his arm, and they moved silently to the top end of the island. Then they crept forward on hands and knees, until they could lie and look across the open stretch of water at the beach, where the boats from the Gull and the Golden Bough were drawn up below the encampment. While they kept watch, Hal explained the finer details and small modifications to his original plan. From time to time, Abelie's tattooed head nodded. In the end, he said, "It is a good and simple plan, and if the gods are kind, it will work." In the sunset, they studied the two ships anchored in the channel and watched the activity on the beach. As it grew darker, the teams of men who had worked all day digging the buzzards' trenches were relieved. Some came down to bathe in the lagoon. Others rowed out to their berths on the Gull. Smoke from their cooking fires spiralled up through the trees and spread in a pale blue haze across the waters. Hal and Abelie could smell grilling fish on the smoke. Sound carried clearly across the still water. They could hear men's voices and even make out something of what they were saying, a shouted oath or a boisterous argument. Twice Hal was sure that he recognised the buzzard's voice, but they had no further sight of him. Just as darkness began to fall, a longboat pulled away from the side of the Golden Bough and headed in towards the beach.
"That's Sam Bowles in the stern," he said, and his voice was filled with loathing. "Captain Bowles now, if what Jiri tells me is true," Abelie corrected him.
"It is almost time to move," Hal said, as the shapes of the anchored ships began to merge with the dark mass of the forest behind them.
"You know what to do. And God go with you, Abelie."
Hal gripped his arm briefly.
"And with you also, Gunduani."
Abelie rose to his feet and went down into the water. He made no noise as he swam across the channel, but he left a faint phosphorescent trail on the dark surface. Hal found his way back through the bush to where the others waited by the ungainly shapes of the two fireships. He made them sit in a tight circle around him while he spoke to them softly. At the end, he made each repeat his instructions and corrected them when they erred.
"Now, nothing remains but to wait until Abelie has done his work."
Abelie reached the mainland and left the water quickly. He moved quietly through the forest, and the warm breeze had dried his body before he reached the cave of the paintings. He squatted beside the powder kegs and made his preparations as Hal had instructed him. He cut two fuses from the slow match. One was only a fathom in length, but the second was a coil 30 feet long. The time delay was an imprecise calculation, and the first might burn for 10 minutes, but the second for almost thrice as long. He worked swiftly, and when both kegs were ready, he tied the bundle of 3 cutlasses on his back, swung a powder keg up onto each shoulder and crept out of the cave. He remembered that the previous night, when he had visited the hut in which Jiri and the other slaves were being held, he had observed that the buzzard's men had become careless. The uneventful months they had been camped here had lulled them into a complacent mood. The sentries were no longer vigilant. Still, he was not relying on their sloth. Stealthily, he moved closer to the camp, until he could clearly make out the features of the men sitting around the cooking fires. He recognized many. But there was no sign of either Cumbrae or Sam Bowles. He set up the first keg in a patch of scrub on the perimeter of the camp, as close as he dared approach, and then, without lighting the fuse, moved away until he reached one of the trenches where the buzzard's men had been digging for treasure. He placed the keg with the longest fuse
on the lip of the trench and covered it with sand and debris from the excavation. Then he paid out the coiled fuse and took the end of it down into the trench. He crouched there and shielded the flint and steel with his body so the flare of sparks would not alert the men in the camp as he lit the slow match. When it was glowing evenly, he lit the fuse from it and watched it for a minute to make certain that it was also burning well. Then he climbed out of the trench and moved swiftly and silently back to the first keg. From the slow match in his hand, he lit the shorter fuse. "The first explosion will bring them running," Howell had explained. "Then the second keg will go off in their faces." Still carrying the bundle of cutlasses, Abberley moved away swiftly. There was always the danger that the flame of one of the fuses might jump ahead and set off the keg prematurely. Once he was clear, and moving with more caution, he found the path that ran down towards the beach. Twice he was forced to leave the path, as other figures came towards him out of the darkness. Once he was not quick enough, but he brazened it out, exchanging a gruff "Hurray!" with the pirate who brushed past him. He picked out the mud hut against the glow of the campfires and crept up to the back wall. Jiri responded immediately to his whisper. "We are ready, brother." His tone was crisp and fierce, no longer the cringing whine of a slave. Abberley laid down the bundle of weapons and with his own cutlass severed the twine that held them. "Here," he whispered, and Jiri's hand came out through the crack in the mud wall. Abberley passed the cutlasses through to him. "Wait until the first keg blows," he told them through the hole in the wall. "I hear you, Abberley." Abberley crept to the corner of the hut and glanced round it. The guard sat in his usual position in front of the door. Tonight he was awake, smoking a long-stemmed clay pipe. Abberley saw the burning tobacco glow in the bowl as he drew upon it. He squatted behind the corner of the wall and waited. The time passed so slowly that he began to fear that the fuse on the first keg had been faulty and had burned out before reaching it. He decided that he would have to go back to check it, but as he began to rise to his feet, the blast swept through the camp. It tore branches from the trees and sent clouds of burning ash and sparks swirling from campfires. It struck the mud hut, knocking down half the front wall and ripping the thatch from the roof. It hit the guard by the front door and hurled him over backwards. He floundered about on his back trying to sit up, but his big belly made him ungainly. While he struggled, Abberley stood over him, placed one foot on his chest, pinning him to the earth, swung the cutlass, and felt the hilt jar in his hand as the edge hacked into the man's neck. His whole body spasmed and then lay still. Abberley leapt away from him and grabbed the rope handle of the rough-hewn door to the hut. As he heaved at it, the three men inside hurled their combined weight upon it from the far side, and it burst open.
"This way, brethren,"
Abberley led them down towards the beach. The camp was in uproar. The darkness was full of men blundering about, swearing, shouting orders and alarms. "To arms! We are attacked!" "Stand to here!" they heard the buzzards roar. "Have at them, lads!" "Petey, where are you, my darling boy?" a wounded man screamed for his shipwife. "I am killed! Come to me, Petey!"